Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Rochester, Michigan, and earned a bachelor's degree in history from the University of Michigan and a JD from Michigan State University College of Law. While practicing law for the last 25 years, he was the majority leader of the Michigan Senate from 2007 to 2010, and from 2015 to 2018, he served in the U.S. House of Representatives for Michigan's 8th District. His name, Mike Bishop, and we're honored to have him as our guest. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Mike Bishop, who for the last 4 years served in the U.S. House of Representatives for Michigan's 8th District. Mike, welcome. A real honor to have you.
I'm honored to be here. Thanks, Jack.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and your mom and your dad?
Okay, sure. We can start anywhere you want to. That's a good place to start, I guess. I was born and raised in Rochester, Michigan. I have four older sisters. My mom and dad still live. I still live in Rochester, Michigan with my three kids and my wife. My mom and dad still live there as well. They're about 3 miles away from me.
What's the biggest thing you learned from Dad, and what's the biggest thing you learned from Mom?
Well, that's a great question, and there are so many things to learn from your parents. I'm still learning from my parents. I think probably the biggest thing I learned from my father was a work ethic and a sense of pride in what I do every day. And my mom has taught me an attitude of gratitude. She is positive about everything, and I view that as one of the most important values that you can have in life, is to have that attitude of gratitude.
Mike, when you were growing up, what did you want to be?
I wanted to be my dad, but I also wanted to be a professional football player and a baseball player and all those things kids want to be. But I really, you know, when I was growing up, I watched my parents, and I, in particular, watched my dad, who was a lawyer before me. And I admired the way he looked at life and how he viewed his responsibility in life is to help other people. And that was just something that we were taught growing up. It wasn't about money or wealth or, you know, what big house you live in or what kind of fancy car you drive. It's what you contribute to the world. And I really value my father and my mother for instilling in me that kind of view of the world.
How was it you chose a career in law?
Well, like I said, I was bound and determined to be my dad at some point in time. And he was a great experience for me to grow up with and watch. And so I became a lawyer because I think he was a lawyer. And I was very interested in doing the same things he did, having clients, representing people, and helping others.
They talk about the practice of law. You know, they don't talk about the practice of surgery or the practice of sales. A lot of people say that law is a calling, a vocation. Why so?
Well, it all goes to how you view your role in the world. And we all at some point in time have to help each other do certain things. And I think everybody in this world deserves an advocate. As a prosecutor, as a local prosecutor, I enjoyed the opportunity to be an advocate for victims of crimes. I enjoyed being an advocate for the community that I represented as a local prosecutor. As an independent lawyer, I felt it was important for businesses and for families to have an advocate in the process that could be extremely overwhelming for folks. And so I spent a lot of time with people, with organizations to try and walk them through the process and make the process easier for them. They were going through something difficult. My job was to make it easier.
You mentioned that you wanted to be your dad and you followed him in the practice of law. He also was a public servant. Talk about his career in serving Michigan?
So when I grew up, all the way up until the sophomore year in high school at Rochester Adams High School, I watched my father in the process of going through his different variations of state house, state senate, and I learned early on the values of being a public servant. And much of that I learned from my father, but much of that I learned from my mother too, because she was the one that took us from one event to the next. She was there at the house when he was in Lansing doing his work, but he was a very conscientious person who believed strongly in this idea of being a public servant, going to work every day and representing people. That was back in the day when you made $5,000-$6,000 a year doing that job. So he was a servant going to work, representing people, but at the same time, he had his main job. He was a lawyer. So he worked hard. He worked Saturdays, never on Sunday, because my father and mother believed that Sunday was a day of rest and day of family. So we always spent time with the family on Sunday.
Talking about working hard, how was it you decided on your first run for political office in 1998, and how hard was it running that first campaign?
So I ran against a number of Republicans, a Republican district. I was a Republican. There were four other candidates, all of whom had the right to have the job. Big names, big money, big wallet. I was a young upstart. I think the local paper said that what I lacked in experience, I gained in youthful exuberance was the phrase that they used. And that's true, because what I didn't have, money and name, I gained by walking door to door. I went to I went to 15,000 homes in that election cycle, walking door to door, knocking on doors, and asking for support. And to this day, I run into people at Kroger or at Meijer, wherever I am, and they say, you know what, I remember you came to my door one day, and we talked for a long time. And I did that. That's really how I got elected, was walking door to door. I won that primary, and I shocked a lot of people because other folks were supposed to have won.
We're talking to Mike Bishop. When we come back, we're going to ask him about the best advice his dad ever gave him about running for office and then serving in office. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula. We're with Mike Bishop, who from 1999 to 2002 served in the Michigan House of Representatives for the 45th District. Okay, Mike, your dad. What's the best single piece of advice he gave you about running for office? And then what's the best thing he told you about serving in office?
Well, there was considerable trepidation by my father when he realized that I had an interest in running for elected office, because he had been there. He knew the pitfalls. He knew the ins and outs. He was concerned about the path that I chose. He understood it because he knew that my entire life I was raised to be a part of the community and give back to the community. But there was concern. And I think, especially being that I was running for state government, where he had spent 16 years of his career, and many of the people that he knew were still there, lingering. So there was concern about getting into that world. But I think the best advice my father gave me was, remember in life that you have real friends and you have political friends, and you should always keep your real friends very close to you, because the people you meet in government don't necessarily want to have anything to do with you when you leave government.
All right. In 2000, Governor Engler says to a few of you, we're going to go down to Austin, Texas, and spend some time with this governor of Texas, George W. Bush.
Right.
I think we should get to know him. I think he wants to run for president. So you go down there, you spend a few days. What happened?
Well, I had intended to support Steve Forbes in that election, because I liked the idea of his flat tax. Governor Engler convinced me at the time that I should go down and meet this this very influential governor of the state of Texas, obviously the son of the former president of the United States, George H.W. Bush, and had a great opportunity down there. I went down and spent some time, and we had personal moments with the governor. I was there that long where we just kind of walked around his house in the governor's mansion and had a chance to really speak with him individually. So I had a great experience, and I really enjoyed the conversation. Was amazed at how sincere he was and how driven he was on the idea of representing this country. I love elected officials who lead with the idea that the reason why they're in elected office or the reason why they want to run for elected office is because they love their country. That to me is a prerequisite for anybody who wants to run for public office, and he just exuded that in every conversation that we had.
Yeah, you spent a lot of time one-on-one with him down there, but at one point you said, Governor, we have something in common.
Yes, I did say that. Good memory, Jack. I said to him, Governor, it was an awkward moment because we were just standing there, and I was the only one with him, and we were kind of waiting for pictures. I don't remember what the situation was. But I thought, you know what, I'm going to interject a thought. And I said, Governor, you and I are a lot alike. And I immediately regretted saying that after it left my mouth, because there really is nothing that we have alike in a lot of ways. But I said, Governor, I'm following my father into politics just like you did. And he got a big smile on his face, and he said, he's not known for his being very profound, I wouldn't say, but he looked at me and he said, you know, I'll tell you about that. You know, when you follow your father into politics, you inherit 100% of his enemies and 50% of his friends. And I thought, you know what? My dad tried to tell me that a long time ago. But that really hit the nail on the head for me, and it's very true. You have to walk into this process with your head up, and assume that you know that you got people gunning after you, and even the people that call you your friends in politics are not necessarily your friends.
Okay, the chapter of your life from 1999 to 2002, you were in Michigan House of Representatives. Talk about that chapter.
Well, that was my first foray into elected government. I was in my late 20s at the time. I was young for that generation of leadership, and had a chance to work with the then Governor Engler, who to this day I consider the master politician, the guy who really understood the not just when I say politician, I don't mean that as a negative. To me, he just understood the legislative process. He understood the rules. He understood how government worked together. He was a fascinating person to work with because he was a teacher in that process. So I feel like I had a great experience in the state house, but there were 110 members. It just seemed too big to really make a difference. And I yearned for the day when I'd have a chance to go to the upper chamber into the Senate where there were only 38 members and you had a better chance to make a difference.
Be careful what you pray for, huh? All right. You served in Lansing for 12 years.
I did.
Talk to us about the people of Michigan as you learned about them in those 12 years.
I love my state. I was born and raised here. I will spend my days here, and I know my family feels the same way. I really enjoyed the opportunity to get to know Michigan. I spent that 12 years going from city to city, county to county, getting to know the different ways about each of those areas. It's so unique in so many ways. Our state is so beautiful, has so many great assets, natural resources, things that other states just don't understand. And perhaps I didn't really truly appreciate that until I got to Congress and I started talking to other people from different states who had never been to Michigan, who didn't understand it. And it gave me an opportunity to really brag about our state and who we are, what we stand for, and why Michigan is a great place. I happen to think that I've done a great job for my state in making sure that we have lots of visitors in the future, because I know a lot of members of Congress, they're going to come and visit Michigan because of conversations they've had with me.
All right. Then you were in the Michigan State Senate for 8 years, 2003 to 2010. Talk about that chapter.
Well, that was a wonderful time in my life. I had a chance to really do a lot of, I think, meaningful things legislatively. I introduced and passed the Michigan Identity Theft Protection Act, which elevated that crime. It's pervasive in our country now, and Michigan became a leader in that area of the law. I introduced the Michigan Child Protection Act. I was an advocate for families and kids, but I also brought to task my background in the law and my protection, my advocacy for victims of crimes. So I enjoyed that part of my life. The Michigan Senate was small enough where you could get things done. And when I ran for my second term, I was honored by my caucus to represent them as the Michigan Majority Leader, Michigan Senate Majority Leader. And that was the thrill of my life, to be able to do that, to captain that ship and be a part of that process.
That was from 2007 to 2010. As Majority Leader in the state, what does that position consist of, and how did you try to herd those cats?
Well, back then, we had a one person majority, one member majority in the Michigan Senate, and the rest of the state was run by the Democrat Party. So the House was run by Andy Dillon, the Speaker of the House, who was a Democrat, and of course we had Governor Granholm at the time. So this was a difficult time to be Majority Leader, because I was not only the Majority Leader of the Michigan Senate, but I was also their chief advocate, their chief negotiator in the process. You have a $48 billion budget, and that put me in the hot spot every year to ensure that we properly, responsibly balanced our budget, because Michigan has a balanced budget amendment. And we went through some pretty difficult times in Michigan. We all remember that. It hit, an apex in terms of its difficulty in 2008, 2009. It was difficult to balance a budget back then. During those 4 years, is the only time in Michigan government history where state spending out of state resources actually went down over 4 years. So we actually reduced the size of government in that 4 years. And I, to this day, think back on how we did that, and it was not easy. We had a group that was resistant to that idea, and I understand it, because government oftentimes wants to metastasize over time, and that's kind of the way I view big government, is that it will continue by momentum alone to grow. So it was good to be able to kind of go back to square one and look at the difference between wants and needs and build a budget based on that.
We're talking to Mike Bishop. When we come back, he was in a lot of meetings those 4 years with Jennifer Granholm, the governor, Andy Dillon from Redford, who had been a Republican, I think, Mike,
yeah,
and went become a Democrat, and you. When we come back, we got to have a couple of special stories about some of those meetings. Yeah. And I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Rasul, and we're with Mike Bishop. From 2007 to 2010, he was the Majority Leader of the Michigan Senate. All right, many meetings with Governor Jennifer Granholm, Andy Dillon, good friend. Tell us a couple stories about those meetings.
Well, I have plenty of stories. Andy Dillon, although the Democrat Speaker of the House, was a good friend and remains to be a good friend to this day, and we had our disagreements during those times. But I think we bonded in a way that most leaders do not bond in government, in that we oftentimes felt like we were on the opposite side of the negotiating table of our own governor. We would go and negotiate deals oftentimes in our office, in the ceremonial office in the Capitol, and think we had a deal. And we would walk away to our respective caucuses, brief them on what was going on, and prepare them for the next day in the process. And sure as shooting, she would come back after spending time with her husband the night before, and she had decided that that was not the deal at all. And in fact, seemed a little bit perplexed at how we could ever think that she agreed to anything. So it was frustrating at times. She was a very frustrating person to work with at times. And we at a difficult time in our state's history, we needed a decisive leader, and not someone who put their finger in the air and tested the wind, the political wind. I recall one time being in her office, and this to me was very telling. There was a press conference in the rotunda on the subject of infrastructure and spending on infrastructure. And I remember saying to the governor, as I was meeting with her, aren't you supposed to be down there? And she said, no, I'm not going down there. And I'm thinking to myself, wait a minute, she was part of this rollout in the first place. And the reason why she didn't want to go down there is because it had become politically a hot potato, this idea of spending more money on roads. So she wanted nothing to do with it. And they had to wiggle on the hook down there. And eventually we got nothing done on roads because there was no leadership, period.
And 9 years later, the other day, Gretchen Whitmer got up and had a press conference on infrastructure and roads. So
Gretchen Whitmer was there at the time. So, you know, I think she learned that valuable lesson.
Okay, then you go on to Washington.
Huh?
Spent the last 4 years in Washington. Looking back, what's the biggest difference between Lansing and Washington?
Well, that's... Lansing, there was an opportunity to, I view my role in anything that I do, if I go to it and I do it, I want to bring value. So in Lansing government, in state government, the value you bring is getting things done legislatively. You can actually move the ball down the field, which to me is important. You get to Washington, D.C., though, and that's not so easy. It's very frustrating because of the loggerheads that exist in the federal government. So you learn that your primary purpose in the federal government is to really make sure you take care of your constituents and be constituent oriented. That part I really enjoyed. I've always viewed my office as the number one priority being constituent service. There are two parts of any legislative office. There's a legislative side and there's a constituent side. In Washington, D.C., the constituent service side is the most important and the primary focus.
And you served from the 8th District of Michigan from 2015 to 2018. Talk to us about the people of the 8th District.
Well, this is something that I spent a great deal of my time in state government representing the same people. I've lived in this Rochester community my entire life. So I go to the store and meet people that I went to high school with and went to grade school with. This is what I love about my job is the opportunity to represent the people that I grew up with and my family. You know, some of my most difficult constituents are my family members. So, I mean, my dad and my mom, you know, you have to make sure that you take good care of them as well. But I think probably the reason why I love it so much is because it's very personal to me. I graduated from the various schools. All my kids are going to the same schools. It's surreal for me to think about the fact that my oldest son is now going to be 19 years old, and my daughter is 17 today, and my youngest is 13. So I spent a lot of time here, and I know a lot of people, and I love my community. That's why I love doing what I do.
It seems to me most every guy that meets you maybe doesn't ask you, but what he's thinking is, whether it's you or Christina that buys that shampoo and that conditioner, how do you get that hair to look that good, Bishop?
I tell you what, the hair has been...
I'd die for that hair.
Well, I tell you what, it's changing dramatically over the years. And I don't think it'll turn gray. I think it'll just fall out before my career is over.
Okay, a couple weeks ago, the latest Congress started. And there were a whole bunch of rookies showing up. What advice would you give those first-term congresspeople?
I think the most important thing I would tell them is to meet people, talk to people. I made it a point every day when we were in session to talk to someone different. Every day. And I would have a conversation. I would talk about their family, what they do, what inspires them. I wanted to hear more about them, and then so that I could kind of open up my sphere of influence over the years. And I didn't do it with just Republicans and Democrats, but I did it with Democrats as well. And I really learned a lot from people, and I would suggest to everyone who gets elected to any office, take your time, meet everybody, talk to everybody, approach them, invite them to coffee or for lunch, or just sit next to them during the session period and talk to them. It makes a big difference, and it will make you a better legislator. It'll make you a better public servant in the long run.
All right, let's magically pretend that we're setting up a new country. Blank sheet of paper, okay? So we're going to have Thomas Jeffersons and George Washingtons, etc. Of those people that you met in Congress and in the Senate, were there a couple that you'd say, wow, they got to be on the committee to set this thing up?
Oh, I think about that a lot. That's a great question. Yes, I've met so many people that I would include as my founding fathers. I think Paul Ryan is a public servant that I would offer up as a person who understands the policy, but he's also motivated by honesty, truth. He's got a great moral compass. I really admire him. Another person that I met is Trey Gowdy, from the East Coast, and what a fantastic person he is. I was in the judiciary with him, and I have never heard anybody with such a command of his thoughts, his clear thinking. And it is, I'd pay a fee to come and watch him every day. He is that good. And it is not, he's 100% authentic. It's not made up. It is just something that he believes. Now, these are people that love their country again. That's really the common denominator. You got to love your country, and you got to be there for the right reason.
Speaking of spending time with your fellow congresspeople, let's go back to June 14th, 2017. Early in the morning, where were you? What happened?
Well, every year, Congress has a baseball game, and members of Congress, Republicans, play the Democrats. We raise money for children's charities. I played in four different sports in Congress at raising money for charities. So I raised millions of dollars for children's charities playing basketball, baseball, football. I even played soccer. I never even played soccer before. I didn't even know that was, it wasn't a sport in my school when I was growing up. But
do they cheat? Do the each side cheat? Okay, we ain't going there.
Right. No. We were up and up. But that day on June 14th, 2017, I was actually on a baseball field, 7 o'clock in the morning. We were practicing, and that was the day that the shooter came in. And I was standing at home plate, watching batting practice, and I actually saw. I heard the first shot, and everybody kind of looked at each other and couldn't figure out what was going on. And I happened to look right across the field and saw this guy on the third base line, just outside the backstop. And I saw the weapon in his hand, and I saw him raise it, point it, and pull the trigger again. And everybody was yelling at that point, "Shooter, shooter!" Our third baseman, who would serve two tours in Iraq, came running across, and he was yelling "shooter." He was running in a zigzag pattern. I'll never forget that. I hit the ground on the first baseline, and I looked up, realized that there was no place to go because there was only one way out of that place. It was right along the first baseline, right next to our dugout. The entire team jumped into the dugout. I couldn't even make it to the dugout. And I looked over, and I watched Steve Scalise, our second baseman, who was starting to come back, get shot. I watched him fly up in the air and land on his back. I heard the scream, and I will never forget the scream. And that really, that moment in time is impressed permanently. I hear it. I can feel it. I can smell it. I can smell the gunfire to this day.
We're talking to Mike Bishop, and I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible, a News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible. We're talking to Mike Bishop from 2015 to 2018. He served in the U.S. House of Representatives for Michigan's 8th District. Mike, it seems to me that whether you're on the donkey side or the elephant side, every morning somebody gives you talking points. And this is what you better say, and if you don't, you get thrown off of this committee, put on this junk committee, and you ain't going to get no money in 2 years to run for re-election. Who creates the talking points?
There are always talking points. Every caucus, every conference, everybody's got a talking point. It's not something that you, I never memorized. It's something that you review and you have to apply to your knowledge about whatever it is that you're voting on that day or whatever the issue is of the day. But I think it's a misconception by a lot of people who think that that's the only thing we say. I think it's important that members go to represent the people that of their constituency in a way that they have portrayed themselves to be, how they campaigned. What were their promises? And even if there are talking points, if they are inconsistent with what you said you were going to do, you have got to deviate from the scripted part and be your own person. The first thing you always do is vote your district, vote your conscience, but vote your district. And there are often times where talking points are in front of me that are inconsistent with both of those things. And I'll tell you very clearly, it doesn't matter to me at all. And I would say this for most people that I know. If they're inconsistent, you have got to stay the course. Plant your feet firmly in what you believe and be strong. Stay the course.
I was with Dr. Larry Arnn of Hillsdale the other day.
Great man.
You know, he knows the founding fathers and the mm-hmm. Constitution. He made a statement. He said, Jack, 9 out of 10 laws today are not made in Congress.
Uh-huh.
The courts and the government employees in these various departments are the ones making all the laws.
That's right.
But that ain't no good. That's not how it was set up to be. How does that change, Mike?
One of the first bills I introduced was to address that issue.
Didn't go very far.
But the problem is in the federal government, the agencies, the unelected bureaucrats, the departments, they issue and promulgate rules, which have the force and effect of laws in the event there is not a law there. So there is no way to change that other than to pass a congressional act to change it. There's no system in place that says, hey, whoa, before that goes into effect, Congress has got to check in on it. But it is the role of Congress. Article 1, Section 8 of Congress says that it is our responsibility as members of Congress to pass laws. That's what we do. I think what's happening in our agencies and our departments is unconstitutional. And I think over the next years, you're going to find the courts weighing in on that subject, I hope, because it's only complicating the world we live in. And, you know, Department of Labor, the EPA, I have one complaint after the next about not just those departments, but all of them for what they do to justify their own existence. We have got to take back control of government. It's supposed to be a government of the people, by the people, and not by bureaucrats who are unaccountable to the people. That's tyranny.
Whether you love the Trumpster or hate him, the economy is booming. People are working. They're getting raises. The government is getting more money now in tax revenues than ever. 8 years ago, everybody's screaming, you know, the deficits are $1 trillion under President Obama. This last year, it was still the deficit was over $1 trillion with all-time record income. Mike, what do we do?
Well, the budgeting process, the appropriations process in our federal government, if there's one thing I can say on this subject, looking back, it's broken. And one of the reasons why is that the House will pass appropriation bills, and they die in the Senate because the Senate has this 60-member threshold rule that requires, even if there's a Republican majority or a Democrat majority, they can't get anything done because they can't hit that 60-vote threshold. I think the last time they had 60 votes was when Obama was president, and they were able to get some stuff done then, but even then, they couldn't pass a budget. In my opinion, the only way you're going to be able to get this budget under control is if you get rid of that 60-vote rule for the purpose of passing an appropriations bill. It's really, we will never get any balanced budget. We will never bring back any responsibility to the budgeting process until we get rid of that rule.
On the evening of December 5th, Tom Wilson, myself, were with you and Christina at Reagan Airport waiting to come back on the plane. You and Christina had gone to George H.W.'s funeral and tribute in the National Cathedral. Tom Wilson and I hadn't gotten in there. That was special. What struck you about that funeral on December 5th, 2018?
The reverence this country has for its presidents is just unbelievable. It's not a Republican thing. It's not a Democrat thing. It is an American thing. George H.W. Bush lived one of the most honorable lives of any of our American presidents. And he was honored that day by a number of people. And it was just such a special thing to be a part of it, to be a part of that moment in history, to honor a man who had done so much, not just in his private life, but as a member of the armed services. And he was the youngest pilot in World War II, shot down, held prisoner, became director of the CIA, member of the Senate. President of the United States. The man was, I think, quintessential public servant and great American.
You served 4 years in Congress in Washington, and you were running again for another term where you were going to be paid $174,000 a year times 2 years, so you would potentially make $348,000 in that two-year job. Alyssa Slotkin was running against you, and the powers to be spent $35 million, Mike Bishop, against you in that campaign. On the south side of Chicago, that don't add up. What do we change?
I don't know. The previous cycle, my opponent and I spent a little over $1 million on the election. So, you know, that's too much. I think that the process, the system is very vulnerable to people who can buy a seat. So if you're George Soros, if you're Mike Bloomberg, if you are Steyer, some of these other huge billionaires, they can influence the outcome of the election. Forget about the Russians. We have elements in our own country who can influence the outcome. And we've got to figure out the Citizens United decision by the Supreme Court has made it difficult for us to get past this. It makes us very vulnerable to influence and manipulate, frankly, the outcome of our elections. And $35 million was the price tag for my seat. And that's why they spent that. And they succeeded.
Well, you've had a fabulous 16-year chapter in serving public office. God's got another phenomenal chapter waiting for you. And you'll be great and successful at whatever it is.
I believe that.
Thank you. Please join us next Saturday. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening. And make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spawn. Believe in yourself.